This is Revolution. Welcome, everyone. For most of you, this will be the Wednesday show. For select few of you, this will be the patrons' early edition that they get from the day before Tuesday. For those of you that watched it live, this is the audio of a conversation we had with Professor Joseph Farag out of the University of Minneapolis about changing sentiments around Palestine and the Israel. I don't want to say conflict, because conflict to me is a little... doesn't paint it very accurately. There's changing sentiments around Israel, Palestine. You hear more and more people, actually in mainstream media, addressing the situation as an apartheid, looking at Israel as an apartheid government, acknowledging the horrible conditions that Palestinians live in. There was a video that went viral of, I can't think of the guy's name, but you hear the woman say, "You're stealing my house." So I think these videos have helped put a human face that's gone further than the rhetoric that you hear coming out of Israel and the U.S. Israel acolytes. Saying that, there are still a lot of politicians that are still, you know, going down this. If you say anything bad about Israel, you're being anti-Semitic, and watch what you say. So anyway, we had a good discussion with Professor Joseph Farag about changing attitudes. Now, if you want to see something like that live, while it's going on, participate in the conversation. There's only one way to do it. You got to watch the show live. You got to follow us on all the social medias. So, you know, Facebook, we do a Facebook Live. We do a Periscope Live, which is through Twitter. We do a Twitch stream at the same time. And our favorite is YouTube. Say the majority of people watching the show at this point now are watching it on YouTube via live stream. That's youtube.com/ This Is Revolution Podcast every Tuesday at 6 p.m., every Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific time, and Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific time. This show was last, as I record this, June 1st. Happy birthday to one of my best friends in the whole wide world. He's been on this show a bunch of times, Coach Will Liu. He's the coach at Oakland High. If you're familiar with the NBA player Damian Lillard, he's his basketball coach in high school. He's also been my best friend since high school. We're like brothers. Happy birthday, as I say this, Will. Also recently, a birthday pass for our moderator, John Ross. Happy birthday, moderator John Ross. He doesn't just moderate this show. I believe he moderates Kenzo Shibata's show. Hopefully I'm not lying on Kenzo. And I believe he moderates Joe Payne's Political Pain. John Ross is a busy beaver. Just turned 30. Happy 30th. And if you don't know, there's two things that we do that are not on the This Resolution channel, and that is we do every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern time, we do a Twitch stream with Marcus of the Left Flank Lance. So we do a stream called It's Not a Barbershop. My co-host Pascal Robert and I and Marcus of the Left Flank Lance, who's also one of the hosts on the the Saturday crew. He's part of the Saturday crew. He's part of the This Is Revolution family. We feel like we're part of the Left Flank Vets family, even though we are not veterans. And we are doing a video essay series for Zero Books called The Dispatch. The first is out now. It's a critique of Nomadland. The second one is coming. So as you are listening to this on Wednesday, June 2nd, it should be out on Zero Books. I don't know what Doug is going to title it, but it is a take on Haiti, the black political class, the Democratic Party and the black political class, written by my co-host Pascal Robert, narrated by me. It's called The Dispatch. And if you're listening to this show, and when we go to, we're going into the second hour, there's only one way to get that second hour, and that is become a patron. It's easy. Patreon.com/BitterLakePresents. It's cheap. It's fun. We have a Discord. We have movie night, which we've been partially lagging because of some extra things that we're doing here, like with this new video essay series, and also Pascal's book and some of his new writing. I think he's got a new piece coming out, Black Agenda Report. That'll be an expansion on that video essay. So we've been kind of holed up with that. But for patrons, I will talk to Pascal to see if we could release this essay we're doing a little early. That being said, this is our show with Joseph Faraj, professor at the University of Minnesota. Changing attitudes towards talent. Thank you. Enjoy the show. And I am out.
Recent flare-up in violence in Israel and the occupied territories has once again thrust the Palestinian question into the forefront of the global news cycle. Until recently, spokespersons for the Israeli government, as well as their supporters in the West, have successfully sought to frame the conflict as a struggle against Palestinian terrorism. However, with this latest round of fighting, that narrative seems to be breaking down. Even within mainstream American media, long since a bastion of pro-Israeli sentiment, voices critical of Israelis' treatment of the Palestinians are increasingly being heard. Indeed, the terminology used by pro-Palestinian activists for decades, including terms such as settler colonialism and apartheid, are now gaining popular currency. What accounts for this shift? How far is it a product of decades of political activism? And what does this mean for the future of relations between Israel and the West? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
Principle of self-defense is something we stand by on behalf of Israel and every other country. Self-defense often does authorize being supported.
Good evening, everyone. How is everybody? Welcome to another Thursday, Foreign Policy Thursday. Let me bring on my foreign policy co-host, coming all the way live from Miami, Florida, Pascal Robert.
I thought I was your regular co-host, not just your foreign policy co-host.
Well, you're like the everything guy. You're my everything.
That's so sweet. No homo.
And it's our favorite expert on everything Kurdish, everything Turkish, if it ends in an ish, he probably knows about it. Mean Gene Bajlan.
Good evening, gentlemen. It's nice to be with you again on a Thursday. It's lovely to see you, Jason. Lovely to see you, Pascal. I hope your new glasses come soon.
Yes, we're working on that. I broke my glasses. My people are already asking in the chat, where's Pascal's glasses? They're like,
so if you see Pascal looking very mean, he's not looking mean. He's just straining to see. That's all that is.
Yes, that's all it is. My glasses broke. Unless you guys are interested in seeing me wear my glasses like this with one arm.
I have a pair exactly like that, and I had to use it.
That's how you have to do it. That's real shit. Glasses break. I told you.
I'm not going to do that. So,
well, let's bring in our special guest before we don't have a lot of time. He is a professor. He has a book out called "Palestinian Literature in Exile: Gender, Aesthetics, and Resistance in the Short Story." He's a professor at the University of Minnesota. He is Joseph R. Farag. Welcome.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Gene. Thanks, Pascal. Thanks for having me.
Can you hear that applause?
I can. Wow, the crowd goes wild.
Ability to get this applause before I had to clap into the microphone. So for over a year, I've been clapping into the microphone. So now,
am I the first person to get the applause?
You're the first person to get the applause. So let's bring you in the right way. Hold on, we're going to bring you in the right way. Coming all the way live from cold-ass Minnesota, Joseph Farag!
See, we're doing the sound effects.
Yeah. You got a problem with it?
We'll talk about it. We'll talk about your introduction meeting.
I'll stop with that. That's all you're going to get with that.
It was more than I expected.
There's more sound effects in here, trust me. But no fart noises. This is a fart noise free show.
So, Professor Farag, I want that we know that currently we have a Palestinian-Israeli crisis going on. in which basically no one has called it a third or fourth intifada at this stage, but because of incursions in the Sheikh al-Jarrah era area, as well as the incursions in Masjid al-Aqsa, the Al-Aqsa Masjid, on the Dome of the Rock during Ramadan and recently as well, Israel breaching ceasefire agreements, that we've been in a tense situation. But one thing has been particularly different about this moment is that the public discourse, as far as I can see in my lifetime, and you know, on the show right now, is more sympathetic to Palestinians than we've ever seen before. I was commenting with some of the comrades about how even Fareed Zakariah of CNN had Noor al-Arakat on talking about Palestine on his show from a very strong Palestinian rights perspective. I'd like you to share with us, as a scholar of Palestinian literature, what are the key factors that are causing this transition in discourse?
Yeah, thanks for that, Pascal. First of all, Joe is more than adequate as an address. You're absolutely right. It's funny. I've never seen a cliche take hold quite as quickly as the one that we are now repeating today, which is that, you know, the paradigm has shifted, the discourse has shifted. There is something palpably different about the way in which Palestine and Palestinians and Israel's relationship to them is being discussed in the mainstream kind of corporate media, even. Like you said, you know, to the extent that Fareed Zakariah is, you know, and I mean, you know, forget that. Even Geraldo on Fox apparently was backing up Rashida Tlaib, saying that she was right. So there is definitely something different about this last round of Israeli aggression towards the Palestinians that is being kind of narrated differently in the American media. And so, I mean, is your question what are the causes of that? How did we get to this place?
I would like to. I mean, I have my opinions. I'm sure Gene has his opinions. But as a scholar of particular Palestinian literature, which means that I would assume that you have a good understanding of the Palestinian narrative, I'd like you to elaborate on what you attribute it to. Is it something internal within the Palestinian liberation movement? Is it BDS? Is it the Netanyahu regime? Is it a combination of all of that? Is it, you know, what exactly are the factors that you see that are contributing to this diminution of support for the Zionist project in the mind and consciousness of at least Americans?
Mm-hmm. So it's you're absolutely right. It's a confluence of factors that have been percolating largely kind of unseen and underground as far as mainstream discourse is concerned, but is the product of you know, a long-term process of advocacy that I think really begins in its current iteration in the post-Oslo era after 1993. So the kind of Palestine campus advocacy movement as we know it today really has its genesis in 1993 in the post-Oslo era, when it becomes apparent that Yasser Arafat and the PLO are perfectly happy to throw Palestinians in exile under the bus if it means maintaining a form of authority, which they subsequently do in the form of the Palestinian Authority that is established after the Oslo Accords. And so Palestinians in exile, seeing that they've basically been left out to dry, start forming a kind of a renewed advocacy program that has its roots, you know, in many different places, but one key kind of site of that grassroots coalition building and advocacy is through, for instance, you know, campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine, the first of which is founded in 1993 in UCLA. So it's not coincidental that the very year of the much vaunted, much celebrated Oslo Accords, which, as I'm sure you'll vividly recall, were celebrated to the skies with, you know, Bill Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn shaking hands, And this was meant to augur, you know, basically the beginning of peace. Palestinians in exile knew better. They were never under any illusions that the Oslo process was going to bring about their right of return, which being a central pillar of the Palestinian demands for justice, if that's not fulfilled, along with, of course, the fact that what was actually offered to the Palestinians was a, you know, not anything that you can actually establish any sort of sovereignty or self-determination through. That began a renewed process of advocacy and of re-narrating the Palestinian experience as not being simply a geopolitical issue between, you know, Arabs and Israelis or Palestinians and Israelis, and it just requires a kind of solution like we saw in Oslo, but rather a broader campaign of advocacy to shift the narrative about how American society more broadly views the Israeli colonization of Palestine itself.
So you would attribute the first iteration of this shift to the Palestinian student activist movements in the West, particularly in the United States, on campuses.
If we're speaking narrowly about the shift in discourse in the United States, I would say that's one key site, and not obviously not independent of other kind of coalitions and forms of solidarity that grew out of it. And I mean, the first time, for instance, that I saw it expand beyond it just being a kind of Palestinian issue was in the wake of Ferguson, where we start seeing connections being drawn between the situation in Palestine and the kind of brutality meted out to Palestinians under occupation versus, the relationship that the police has to Black communities here. And so Ferguson, for me, was the first time that I start to see these threads being pulled together as part of that process. And then, of course, now with all of these factors, and you mentioned Netanyahu, and that's certainly another factor where there was such a clear kind of mirroring between Netanyahu and Trump that even kind of good, you know, self-congratulatory liberals who had previously been able to, unproblematically in their mind, unquestioningly support Israel, the coalition between Netanyahu and Trump kind of made that very difficult for that segment of the American public to maintain that support. So we see, you know, for instance, figures like Bernie Sanders really harp on about this, you know, Bibi Netanyahu's ultra-right-wing ethno-nationalist government as a way of framing at least this current moment of Israeli politics as being particularly reactionary, particularly ethno-nationalist. Which says something about the way in which the Palestinian narrative has managed to kind of reach those kind of people with platforms. But I think there's also an inherent danger in that, because what happens when a less egregiously or forthrightly brutal government takes place in Israel? What happens, for instance, if the Labour Party manages to win an election against all the odds? And we can't, or people like Bernie Sanders can't, you know, brand them as ultra-right-wing ethno-nationalist, even though I think obviously by any reasonable spectrum, they obviously are. But as far as American discourse is concerned, they are the kind of lesser, nicer form of occupation.
So would you also attribute the rise of the new leftists in the coterie of the Bernie Sanders orbit as a kind of a softening factor in terms of the attitudes of American citizens towards the Palestinian issue? In other words, a broadening of leftists. I'm hesitant to say a new left, because I have my position is that, you know, we have more leftists, but not really a left. Do you think that may have added the case? How do you see BDS as a factor?
So BDS is another one of those confluence of factors that obviously is intimately connected to campus advocacy and activism and SJP, but it also has grassroots support within Palestine itself. You know, the BDS movement has its origins within Palestinian society in Palestine. And so BDS is one of those moments where there's been able to be a bridge formed between an otherwise fragmented Palestinian communities. And that's a really important, I think, thing to bear in mind. And I don't know if it's kind of at the forefront of Americans' minds is just how fragmented through a classic colonial system of divide and conquer Palestinians have become. And you know, there's that famous graphic of Palestinian territory from 1940s, you know, 19 whatever, the late 1800s to the present, that shows the territorial fragmentation of Palestine. And that's true. But the fragmentation of the Palestinian body politic itself, I think, is at least as significant a factor when trying to understand these internal dynamics between and among Palestinians themselves, because you have, of course, the West Bank Palestinians and the Gaza Palestinians and the 48 Palestinians who remained in what became the State of Israel and got Israeli citizenship. You have the various Palestinian populations that were dispersed into exile into the refugee camps of the surrounding Arab countries. And you have subsequent generations of Palestinians who have, you know, set down roots in Europe and Australia and the United States, North America, South America, et cetera. And so there's these kind of multiple Palestinian communities that have been fragmented and that have throughout periods of history had, you know, mutual hostilities and acrimony between them for various kinds of reasons. When, for instance, as I said, the Oslo process took place and Palestinians within the West Bank were jubilant because it did offer some kind of modicum of hope, of optimism. Palestinians in exile, as I said, were left out to dry. And so there isn't necessarily a kind of exact overlap of interests between these different population, you know, segments of the Palestinian body politic. And that is a direct consequence of the colonial policies that have machinated the situation to begin with. So BDS becomes one of those moments where there is an opportunity for these groups to coalesce around one another and where there is a kind of resonance of calls for action between Palestinians in the territory of historic Palestine and Palestinians in exile.
And of course, we know that we have to define for our audience, BDS is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, two-level boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the State of Israel for what many are now calling its apartheid treatment of the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. So I want to come back to a little bit of a discussion on the question of activism. And I found it interesting that you noted that this kind of modern iteration of Palestinian activism emerges in the aftermath of Oslo. So it's kind of a twofold question. Firstly, would it then be accurate to say that at this point in the post-Oslo world, the Palestinian movement, or at least Palestinian activism abroad, becomes more detached from the actual political organizations that had been in the lead of Palestine, you know, has an independent life of that, from the political organizations like the PLO that have dominated the Palestinian movement? And the second question I would have is about the differences between this movement and activism in Europe, and particularly in Britain, and in the United States. And you know, you studied in the United Kingdom, so you were familiar with the activism taking place in Britain. And what sort of strikes me is that the kind of at least more sympathetic portrayal of the Palestinians has a longer tradition, for example, in British mainstream media. If you speak to Israelis, they will complain that the BBC is too pro-Palestinian, which is something you probably wouldn't hear Israelis say about, at least until recently, about American news organizations. So I was wondering, do you think sort of the orientation of political activism in Britain and Europe and the United States is different? How is the Palestinian movement viewed in a different manner? And, you know, what explains those differences, and are those differences related to how the Palestinian question is understood by "quote unquote" the normies?
Yeah. So that's I think a really interesting and important point, and has everything, of course, to do with Britain's much longer history of colonial interference in the region and direct responsibility through the League of Nations mandate of Palestine. It's a history that is kind of inescapable for Brits, or is at least much more conscious in the British mind than the history of the U.S. in the Middle East is in the American mind, I think, or at least until recently. Ironically, I think the Britain is moving much more in the direction of the U.S. now, right? And with the adoption of definitions of anti-Semitism that include criticism of Israel or anti-Zionism, the conflation of that with anti-Semitism, of course, the smear campaign against Jeremy Corbyn with claims of anti-Semitism that has everything to do with his positions on Palestine. So as well as a censorship of campus speech about Palestine that is much more reminiscent of the way it's historically been in the United States. So there is this ironic kind of maybe crossing point where, just as the United States seems to be experiencing this paradigmatic shift in how it discusses Palestine, how it understands Palestine, over the course of the past 5 to 10 years, Britain's been going, seemingly to me, in the opposite direction of becoming much more restrictive about what can be said critically about Israel and in support of Palestinian rights. The other thing that I found interesting in my transition from the British Academy to the American Academy and seeing the forms of specifically of campus activism in those two spaces is the way in which, for instance, in the British Academy, for lack of a better word, Palestinian humanity is much more centered, right? So Palestinian advocacy events always tend to center Palestinian culture, Palestinian music, art, poetry, literature. There is this real emphasis on Palestinian society as a multifaceted, complex society like any other that produces art, that produces music and also includes misogyny and patriarchy and internecine conflicts between and among Palestinian groups, classism, etc. And so it's very common to hear talks about, patriarchy in the Palestinian national movement, or, the history of Palestinian aristocratic classism and how that directly contributed basically the semi-feudal system that was in place in 1948, how that contributed to the situation. Palestine advocacy, I find, I feel like there's this shift taking place in the United States where, up until this point, Palestine advocacy has seemed to emphasize the victimization of Palestinians, right? And so when you get a speaker, whether it's Noam Chomsky or Norman Finkelstein or Robert Fisk, or every once in a while, there would be a space provided maybe for a Palestinian to speak for themselves. But in any case, there was always an overarching emphasis on Palestinian victimization, Palestinians as victims of the Israeli regime. And there is, I think, something slightly dehumanizing in that form of advocacy that constantly posits Palestinians as victims. It's an identity that Palestinians themselves have fought very hard. I mean, literally fought since 1967 through the rise of Palestinian armed resistance, have fought to shed the identity and the perception of merely being passive, victimized refugees reliant on handouts from the various countries that, agree to host them in refugee camps for however long they're tolerated. And so that is also, I think, part of the shift that's taking place in discourse around Palestinians here, where it's a move away from Palestinians merely as passive victims and a move towards discussion of Palestinians as active agents.
a question I would like to ask is that as one who focuses on Palestinian literature and popular culture and things of that nature, what exactly is the role of media and artistic penetration in Palestinian social and cultural spaces, either in the West or in Europe, that helps foster a kind of consciousness and awareness of the nature of the Palestinian situation under occupation?
So first, it has to be said that the Israeli state has always viewed Palestinian culture as a paramount threat. So when the Israeli state was founded in 1948, Palestinian homes were looted of their books, and there are vast storage rooms to this day in Israel that house Palestinians' books that were looted in 1948. In 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, one of the key targets that was targeted was, I think it was called the Palestinian Information Center, or it was the part of the PLO that was charged with producing Palestinian film, which at that time was predominantly documentary films. And so there was vast troves of Palestinian film that are to this day lost because they were looted during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And then in this most recent round of Israeli aggression against Gaza, we saw the largest bookstore in Gaza directly targeted by one of these highly sophisticated, laser-guided, highly precise missiles. So there is this overarching sense of a threat posed by Palestinian culture and Palestinian cultural production to the Israeli state. In a way, it's much preferable for the Israeli state to have Palestinians constantly portrayed merely as these abject, passive victims rather than as, you know, cultural producers, as kind of a vibrant society unto itself. And so cultural production has always played this revolutionary role in Palestinian society writ large, since what's called the Nakba, which is normally translated as the catastrophe, which is identified as the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, but I think is better understood as a long-term process that continues to this day. So throughout this ongoing Nakba, Palestinian cultural and literary production, cinematic production, artistic production has played a really key role. To your question particularly about the role that it plays in shaping the discourse in Europe and the United States today, one of the enduring ironies of Palestinian cultural production today is the fact that so many Palestinian authors today cannot write in Arabic anymore due to successive generations of being raised in exile. And so you have this upcoming cohort of Palestinian authors who can only narrate their experience in English. And so there's this profound ambivalence in the fact that on the one hand, the fact that they're writing in English allows Anglophone English speakers who would otherwise not have access to these literary works to be able to read them in English. In that way, Palestinians are allowed to narrate their own experience. Edward Said famously requested permission to narrate way back when. This generation of Palestinian authors are demanding their right to narrate, and they're doing so in English, which means that they're able to reach an audience, you know, that has hitherto been at least indifferent than actively hostile to the Palestinian cause. But as I said, they do so in English. English being the hegemonic language of the two colonial powers that bear the greatest responsibility for the situation the Palestinians are in today, the United States and England itself. And so even as they are able to narrate these experiences in English, it is always with this, it's you know, tainted by the fact that they can only do so in English as a symptom of their displacement and their ongoing inability to return.
Now, I was reading your interview in Arabic literature, and you had said this. You said teaching, which I thought was interesting, teaching Palestinian literature in the American Academy. I think it's imperative to draw connections to the process of settler colonialism in order to compel students to reflect on the fact of American settler colonialism and the parallels between Palestinians and Native Americans. It can be too easy for students to recognize processes of colonial expansion, domination, and dispossession in distant locales while remaining largely oblivious to them in their own backyards. So normalized are they. This is all the more important at an institution like the University of Minnesota, at which I teach, and which is a land-grant university, begging the question of whose land it was that was granted, by whom, to whom, and at the expense of whom. I thought that was such an interesting quote, because I was thinking about that. I was like, oh, you're teaching Arabic literature to, I'm assuming, predominantly American students in Minnesota. So are you constantly using the Native American story to draw your parallel to help people understand?
I wouldn't say constantly, because that is not a narrative that I'm yet familiar enough with to be able to speak on authoritatively. But I certainly do refer students to authors and writings by Native Americans. I put up a map of the current state of, you know, the reservation system in the United States alongside the map of the Oslo Accords and actually the current state of these, you know, Bantustan-like enclaves that Palestinians have been forced into. And, you know, the parallels are just so stark that they speak for themselves. But, you know, there is this weird way in which somehow proximity to something can blind us to it. And so even students who, you know, who can see clear as day that the settler colonial process that took place and that resulted in the Palestinians being in the situation that they're in now, can still be completely oblivious to the fact that that is precisely, or I mean, not precisely, that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And that is, you know, akin to the settler colonial process that took place here on, you know, the Dakota land on which we are occupying. There's this supreme irony in the fact that universities throughout the United States Midwest proudly proclaim the fact that they are so-called land-grant universities without a moment's pause of thinking about the politics of that phrase. You know, so-called woke academies, right? These academies that are all indoctrinating American university students in socialism and communism, and, you know, if the Fox News pundits... I wish I lived in that world. But these universities, you know, have very, very little introspection about the depth of complicity that they have in precisely these settler colonial processes, which is why BDS, to bring it back to the Israeli context, BDS includes academic boycott as a central pillar. And this is one of the most contentious aspects of BDS. Is that it undeniably rubs up against, you know, questions of intellectual and academic freedoms and so on in terms of the observation of academic boycott, but so too does colonization, so too does occupation. Those things, I would say, much more materially impact questions of intellectual and academic freedom, especially for Palestinians in that situation.
I'd actually like to know, does the discourse and the rhetoric that you're talking about, i.e. settler colonialism, i.e. apartheid, does that resonate in Palestine itself? And is it actually used as part of the rhetoric and discourse of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation?
I'd say yes and no. Palestinians have always viewed this as a colonial arrangement. It's not a kind of new innovation. In a very large way, Palestinians are welcoming us to finally catching up with them, to where they've been in terms of the coloniality of the situation. And that is, again, due to the fact that, you know, what preceded the Israeli state was the British colonial mandate, which was established after the First World War. And so for Palestinians, there is a direct continuity here. You know, the Israeli state is another iteration of a colonial force that is ruling over them. And throughout the 1960s, Palestinians found common cause with other anti-colonial regimes. So, you know, Wretched of the Earth is translated into Arabic and gains wide popularity. Mao's Red Book is translated into Arabic and gains wide popularity among Palestinian resistance fighters. There is this kind of south, what we would call today south-south, but what we would kind of, to be more historical, third world solidarity that takes place in the 1960s that is fundamentally predicated on a global anti-imperialist impulse, of which Palestinians saw themselves as an integral part. And so that language is not new to Palestinians. It's new to Westerners in a lot of way to think of it in that way. But the language of coloniality is not new to Palestinians. I think perhaps to a certain extent, and again, you know, there are others who are more well-versed than me in this, but the language of apartheid might be a somewhat new innovation. You know, the language of settler colonialism specifically might be a new kind of formulation. Patrick Wolf, of course, famously is the one who coined the concept of settler colonial elimination of the native as opposed to genocide as a kind of broader umbrella term. If genocide has a very kind of narrow term, that's another term that's been, you know, making the rounds with regards to Palestine. If genocide has a very kind of narrow legalistic definition, elimination is much more elastic and includes things like cultural, you know, targeting cultural centers or legislating identity out of kind of a legal existence, like we saw, for instance, with blood quantum laws, where the population still exists, but it ceases to be legally classified as an indigenous population, or an individual ceases to be considered a member of that indigenous population because the colonial state has decided that they no longer have a kind of sufficient blood quantum to qualify. So that language definitely has resonance for the Palestinian cause. I think, and again, I may be mistaken about this, but I think the terminology of apartheid and so on is a little bit newer, but definitely part of the vocabulary that Palestinians are adopting in order to speak to a Western audience.
Can I ask, in terms of, you know, you have terminologies like settler colonialism coming into kind of popular usage in the United States, however deformed and inadequate it is, there is certainly a larger audience in the United States for a critical assessment of the history of the United States, its relationships with African Americans or Black Americans, as well as its relationship with Native Americans. And we are seeing terms like settler colonialism, Jim Crow, you know, old paradigms such as being apartheid being used to describe the United States. Terms that have been used for a while, but are gaining sort of greater currency amongst white upper middle class professional liberal types, types that may have in decades previously sympathized with Israel and, you know, the plight of the European Jewish community and the creation of a Jewish state following the Holocaust. To what extent do you think, do you suspect that part of the reason that there is at least a greater audience for reassessing the way that Israel interacts with the Palestinian population is in part to do with the fact that greater sections of the American population are engaging critically with American history.
With American history writ large?
Yeah, and particularly with, you know, with Native American, you know, the relationship with Native Americans, with African Americans, and, you know, I'm witnessing those things like the Israeli police are training police in Missouri, for example, and, you know, like seeing these concrete relations and then looking, you know, from those kind of seeds of like, hey, why are the Israeli police training police in Ferguson? Looking back and going, oh, these are actually similar, these are similar dynamics. So they're kind of seeing the manifestation and then drawing a deeper root to it. And so settler colonialism, a term that people may be more familiar, is like, oh, that's something we're now familiar with. And that makes us understand the Palestinian question. And now I'm thinking particularly because of your experience with students and how they react with this kind of, you know, when they do the readings, of course, but how they react with these kind of concepts.
So I'll say this. I don't know if it's part of a larger, broader reckoning with American history per se, but I get the sense, and I've only been living in the United States for the past 6 years, and so there is some speculative element to what I'm about to say, but my sense is that over the course of the past maybe 10 to 15 years, 10 years, say, Americans have gotten a crash course in power, in the dynamics and how power functions societally. I'd always been kind of very confused about how, about a kind of the conspicuous absence of discussions of power in American mainstream political discourses. You know, I was a political science undergraduate in Canada, and I completed an entire undergraduate degree in political science where I don't think the word power was mentioned once. There is this, you know, very kind of state-centric, bureaucratic understanding of politics that is almost entirely denuded of power, of how power functions, that I think has been so inescapable over the course of, you know, the past recent history that, you know, this conspicuous absence in the American mainstream, you know, popular consciousness has been kind of thrust in everyone's face, where it is inescapable, you know, confronting questions of power and how power operates along lines of, you know, of course, race, but also class, which is something that's been conspicuously absent in discussions of, you know, American politics and how it functions. I think for the first time in a very long time, a discussion of class in America, which used to kind of be sublimated into race or something. So I don't know if it's so much a question of a reckoning with history. I don't know if that reckoning has actually properly happened yet, or is it, if it's in the process of happening. Maybe in retrospect, we'll realize that's what it was. I don't necessarily get the sense that it's that, you know, a fully fledged reckoning is taking place, but there is definitely a greater understanding of power among the general American public than I've sensed in the recent past, at least. And in terms of my students, I mean, you know, it might be very different if I were teaching on one of the coasts where you know, the camps are very well entrenched. There is a certain amount of freedom afforded to teaching in the Midwest, where there hasn't historically been a fierce contestation over these issues. Although that's not to say that they've been absent. The first, as far as I'm aware, the first chapter of Students Supporting Israel was in fact founded at the University of Minnesota. So it's a kind of mixed history. It's definitely present, but not as fiercely contested, I think it is on the coasts.
I'd actually like to interject at this point, because we've talked a lot about literature and cultural production. Can you elaborate on the role of social media in terms of the Palestinian opposition movement? How does social media and how does it function, in Palestine with Palestinians, and how does it function amongst Palestinian activists in the West?
I don't know enough about the first part of your question. I would be purely speculative on my part to weigh in on that. So I'm going to maybe suggest someone who's better positioned. I'll have a think about maybe someone else you can have on to talk about that. But I don't want to speculate, basically talk out of my ass about something I don't know about. But I can talk about the role that social media has had in kind of vis-a-vis the West in particular, and how social media has also shaped this shift in discourse that we've been talking about. And it's on the one hand, it's undeniable, but on the other hand, I don't want to overstate it in the same way, for instance, that social media's role was overstated during the Arab Spring. And then all of a sudden, what was a grassroots Arab, movement becomes the social media revolutions and becomes completely obscure. And then all of a sudden, we're supposed to be grateful to Mark Zuckerberg for creating the tools that have allowed us to emancipate ourselves. And so, I'm always a little bit wary of giving social media too much credence for performing, the feats of miraculous feats of liberation that sometimes the more enthusiastic discourses would have it do. Having said that, it is absolutely undeniable that social media has been integral in circumventing the mainstream corporate media, who we now see struggling to catch up in order to maintain their relevance, because the disconnect between the images and the narratives that were coming through directly to the American public through social media were so dissonant with the kind of really stale narratives of both sides and Israel's right to defend itself and the old recycled, rehashed canards that we'd heard over and over again, that social media has played an integral part in bringing that about. It's in the fact that it provides a counterweight to the corporate media, who have so horrendously obscured this whole question. And to go back to the question of power, the kind of the framing of both sides and of Israel responding to Hamas missiles and this kind of the false both sidesism of, there are good people and bad people on both sides, becomes really, the asymmetry of power becomes inescapable, again, when viewed through the lens of social media, as opposed through the very sterilized lens of the corporate media. And so absolutely, yeah, social media has been integral in shifting that discussion and in allowing Palestinians to narrate those experiences themselves.
Yeah, I mean, Pascal hit the question exactly that what I was going to ask was about, the role of social media and the increasing difficulty that I think, corporate media or traditional state media has in sort of fostering a particular narrative. If you go back to the 70s, you only see the pictures that are coming out from the news agencies and things like that. But now everybody has a phone and they can upload their TikToks to TikTok. And there was a very striking one where they had TikToks by geolocation, where it was people in Israel like sitting on the beach having a great time and people in Gaza getting struck. Kind of an auxiliary question to this. So I think the point, and I just want some clarification. When you say Americans are increasingly confronting power, would you say this is, social media and the fact that camera phones are ubiquitous? I appreciate your point that social media is a double-edged sword. It creates the panopticon where everybody can be observed and controlled, but at the same time, it makes narrative control a lot more difficult. You have, the buzzword in Washington, D.C. nowadays is about this narrative control and information technology. So do you see this as a sort of similar process to the process of police violence, for example, in the United States, that we see it now? Whereas, you hear about somebody being murdered by the police and it's an intellectual exercise. You hear about, 10 Palestinian children dying and it's an intellectual thing. But we actually see the kids dying there or the black person being murdered, you know, that makes it very visceral. And is that what you see as this confrontation of power, however weak and deformed it is?
I would like to add to that real quick. Do you think, to that point, that these images you start to see ad nauseum, especially when we talk about young Black kids getting shot in the street, to the point of, you know, Palestinian houses being blown up? There's countless images you can pull for Palestinian houses in rubble, and it's no problem to get it. Now, try to pull up any information about Palestine that isn't from an Israeli news source first. If you're digging generically and you don't know the difference between, I don't know, Al Jazeera and what's the Israeli news station, something 24?
I-24.
If you don't really know the difference between that, you're just trying to find information, you're going to get a shit ton of that stuff first on a Google search. So also, what do you say to that? There is something to be said about these images, but what happens when we get too much of these images? It's just constantly in your face.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the, and it's been theorized, you know, for a very long time. If, you know, is there a risk of desensitization with the sheer glut of these images of brutalization? Does the brutalization then become normalized? Is that just then one of those things that defines those people and is therefore accepted and taken for granted? And so, you know, that's been discussed, you know, at great length with photography and the risk of the photograph kind of reifying violence and justifying it somehow. You know, that risk exists, but I think, and we may get there, but the fact is that Israel has been, throughout its existence, incredibly successful at painting itself as a weak, defenseless David against, you know, these barbaric hordes of Arabs that just want to wipe it off the earth. And so that kind of projection of vulnerability and precariousness on the Israeli state, on the part of the Israeli state, was its greatest strength, ironically. And so long as the Arabs were the kind of big bad mean guys, and you know, you played those clips from in the intro, many of which are featured in Jack Shaheen's iconic
Real Bad Arabs.
Bad Arabs. Yeah. You know, the American popular media, I don't mean the news media, but I mean Hollywood. I mean, yeah, you know, all the way up to, you know, HBO or AMC, I can't remember, whoever did Homeland, you know, have been deeply complicit in making Arab lives expendable and in making violence against, you know, vast, you know, kind of industrial scale militarized violence against Arabs not just palatable, but laudable, a cause for celebration. And so what social media has done is completely flipped that script and shown Israel to be not the weak, defenseless David, but rather the Goliath in the equation. And the Palestinians in Gaza, who don't have the benefit of a highly sophisticated missile defense system, or of deep underground bunkers, or of an air raid siren system, or of after several days of bombardment, even of a roof over their heads to protect them against the predations of Israeli militarism. And so social media has been undeniably integral in bringing that shift in perspectives around. I hesitate to say that it's a kind of an indelible shift. Nothing is irreversible. It could very easily have a counter force. So I'm kind of wary of the early celebrations that I've seen taking place on social media, again, of how the, you know, momentous and monumental this shift in discourse is. However, there is something to be said for the fact that it's shifted, and to a very large extent has been due to social media.
It is really, look, I was up to the wee hours of this morning making that 2-minute video. And as I was trying to find news clips, I have to give it to Jean Bajelan, because Jean Bajelan is a scholar in this region. He, you know, more often than not, he gives me good interviews to find. So without Jean, combing through all the bullshit, I had to comb through a lot of Israeli propaganda. And usually what I was finding on, even the BBC and the Guardian, it was always it'll say the conflict between Israel and Palestine, and you may get glimpses of rubble in Palestine, but you'll always see Israeli people running from rockets. And that's the big thing, is rockets. We're running from these rockets. And that's what, makes the social media discourse to me. Like, I do see how it's helping change the perspective, but it's really hard if you don't know where you're going when you do, like I said, a generic Google search for any sort of information about this. Gene, are you frozen, or are you just mad?
No, I'm not frozen.
You're totally frozen.
Do I look mad?
You because you're frozen. Oh, there you go.
I'm not frozen.
Well, we're getting in on the hour, and I did want to address. So we had some super chat questions from Leslie, and I kind of want to just address these to the entire panel. Give me 1 second while I pull these up. Thank you once again, Professor, for taking the time to talk to us today. We do.
You're welcome, but please, I have to insist you call me Joe.
All right. Okay.
I'm not a fan of the academic accolades.
You say this now, Joe, but I'm a touring musician, and the world is opening up, so I'll be in Minnesota in no time. I'll be knocking on your door.
Well, we've got a room for you.
You've said nothing but a word. I hope you like loud punk music.
my 2.5-year-old particularly does. So if you're looking for a bandmate.
Oh, perfect. I have the same age child, and his mom thought it was a great idea to get him drums.
That's pretty cool.
You don't want to let
Jason around your kids and let him talk and around your kids, because things happen, right? We won't talk about it right here, but yeah.
We'll talk about it on this show, on the bonus after hours.
On we'll the bonus app, you'll find we'll
my
we'll
failures talk about as Uncle Jason.
Uncle Jason.
Dad Jason. Nah, Uncle Jason. Pascal, why do we have so many brilliant commentators and so few leaders? Why do we have so many YouTube channels and so few socialist conglomerates? Where are our leaders? Where is our charter?
First of all, do we really have that many brilliant YouTube social media commentators or commentators in general? I mean, I think
we've got Vaj.
There's a good amount. There's something to be said, in my opinion, about people going to that might have been possibly organizers jumping on the YouTube train. But I will say this. Those people probably would have been the Fatback and Biscuits guys that Pascal talks about so much.
I mean, I think that part of the reality that we have, right, is that we have leftists. I strain to say that we have a left. We have a lot of leftists. And I think the class makeup of this particular iteration of the left are, kind of college educated, digitally adept people of a certain age who realize that mainstream media is not going to propagate their message. So they turn to YouTube and social media and the digital platforms. I think that because we have various types of factions, ideas, and worldviews in that space of leftists, that we have different channels, even though some of them have a lot of convergence in terms of their messaging. Why don't we have a leader? I think that I'm not as interested in asking who is our leader as opposed to is where is the movement we have that should be choosing its leader. And I think that part of the reasons why we don't have a movement that would demand a leader is that we don't have enough of an outreach to the working class, poor, and generally what, you know, people call the proletariat, and that many of us, you know, myself included, are really projecting a left ideological project really in spaces of people who are, you know, class secure, a lot of them professional managerial class types that are sympathetic to the message, but aren't the ones who materially need it the most. And we have to find a way to translate these kind of digital platforms into on the ground organizing.
That's a good answer. And this is the last one before we go. How do we turn content creation centered on current events commentary into a vehicle that does not merely suggest action, but facilitates and organizes it? Or do, are we doomed to seethe as atoms forever? These are some bleak questions. These are very bleak questions.
I think the questions are very valid questions. And I think that the questions demonstrate the fact that we basically are, you know, I'm glad that we have left social media alternative voices to mainstream media. I think that's a good thing. I think that there are people who get good political educations from forums like ours, forums like Black Power Media, forums like what Michael Brooks used to do, forums like Zero Books, forums like, you know, Katie Halper and others, even though we may, you know, have various disagreements. I do believe that it is good that we have these platforms that give an alternative narrative to politics and world events than what you will get in corporate media. But at the same time, that is still a type of media. Even though it's more grassroots in perception, media does not start movements. Media reflects the political realities of movements that have been started on the And I think that part of the problem we have is that many of us, perhaps us included here at This Is Revolution, expect media to be the magic kind of Thanos snap or lightning bolt that gives the trigger to the masses to start the mobilization. And I think that what is needed to happen is at best is for us to challenge ourselves, myself included, and our guests, particularly those who are activists involved with left organizations, to ask questions as to when are we going to have public forums in community spaces when we introduce left politics to the constituencies that need them the most. And I don't think we will have left politics until we make those decisions to do those things.
Do you guys want to add anything to that?
Remember to like and subscribe to This Is Revolution. And if you like our content, please make sure to sign up as a patron.
You guys are too much. Well, on that note, thank you very much. Joe, are you coming with us for the bonus act, or are you going to go? Are you turning into a pumpkin?
If you'll have me. I mean, if you're not sick of me yet.
Nah, because I want to actually, before we go, so I watched, I don't know how old you are. That's the one thing I didn't look up was your age. I looked up everything else. But I'll be 44 this year, and I grew up watching Canon films. I had, of course, I had no idea about the propaganda that they were making when I was young, watching these Delta Force movies and all this other stuff that they were making. And I watched an interesting documentary about them that was kind of fun. And on the flip side, I ended up watching Real Bad Arabs, actually, kind of coincidentally. And it really shocked me when I was like, oh, shit. And I watched it again late last night in making that clip. So I definitely want to talk to you a little bit about that portrayal, because the portrayal of Arabs in movies, you can just put it right next to the portrayal of Black people in films as well.
I'll say this. Those films that portray Arabs are hugely popular in the Arab world. Those films that portray Arabs being, you know, turned to Swiss cheese by Chuck Norris's, you know, bullets and huge. Arabs love watching them. There is, I don't know if it's just, you know, feeling grateful that we're on the screen or, you
representation
know.
Matters, Joe.
Representation, yeah, exactly. We're being represented. What
man,
more do you
if want? I hear that one more time, man.
when you see all those clips together, and mind you, I didn't just take a scene from that movie. I actually went and clipped that stuff so you can get it and had to hide it so Disney doesn't ban the show. But watching that documentary and going back, I went to the theater. I took my baby brother to the theater to see it in 92.
So this is, to bring Black and Arab histories together, two of the earliest, I don't need to tell you, what is the first Hollywood blockbuster film in America?
Oh, Lawrence of Arabia?
No.
Star Wars?
Birth of a Nation.
That's the one that the president showed in his special.
Exactly. Yeah, glorification of the KKK and all the rest of it. And alongside that, one of the other first most popular silent films is Rudolph Valentino's The Sheikh, which is likewise a complete dehumanization of Arabs as well. And so it goes back, both anti-Black and anti-Arab, prejudice seems like too soft a word for it, but goes back to the very origins of Hollywood film.
So we're going to talk about this a little bit more and more Middle East stuff on Foreign Policy After Hours Thursday. Thank you, guys. If you're not a patron, go be one for the fun part. You're going to get more sound effects. Because I got some just for the patron part, and I'm very excited. These, very, very excited. So on that note, we are out.